Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and we have an interesting guest this evening. We have Dr. Michael Masters, and he has a very interesting idea of what UFOs could possibly be. And as most of my longtime listeners know, I have absolutely no idea what they are or what's in them, if anything is in them at all. And so I loved hearing different ideas and exploring the different thoughts that people come up with. It's really enjoyable for me. So he'll be coming up right after the news with Alejandro Rojas, who's joining us today in just a minute. I want to thank everyone that helps us out and supports the show. Anyone can do that. That information's over at podcastufo.com. And speaking of that, we have blogs now every week from Charles Lear. Check it out. This week, we have something that's close to home for him. He talks about UFOs in his backyard, and that's just in the area which he lives in the Long Island area, and he involves a number of people that actually have been on the show in the past and talking about what's going on over there, and there has been a lot of sightings out there. I think it's one of the top, I don't know if you want to call it hotspots, but one of the top places in the country where there's sightings in New York. And of course, a lot of that has to do with population. New York City, the most populated city by far. So anyway, that blog is up there. And I think that is it. Next week, I just want to talk about, because I always announce my guest for next week. I don't have a guest for next week. I do. He's going to let me know for sure if he can be on the show, so I don't want to announce his name. But anyway, it's going to be a surprise next week, whoever the guest is going to be. And anyway, I'm going to start the show with Alejandro Rojas. Welcome to the show, Alejandro.
Thank you very much. I am happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm always happy that you're here. And it's been a newsy day, newsy week.
It's been newsy AF. That's how I'd like to put it.
AF, okay. As heck.
As flip,
okay. Thank you for using that word instead of what I thought you were going to say.
Well, you're not supposed to say out the acronym.
Yeah,
that's
true.
The whole point.
Yeah.
But but just so people know, and I've told this people on this on my show, if I use like AF, I mean as flip. I always mean that. Okay. The flip. So
that's good to know.
But anyways, yes, it's been so newsy because so much has been going on. Really, we're kind of in the middle of this mega media blast kind of fervor around UFOs, and it all does tie back and have its everything to do with unidentified America's UFO investigation, which is the television show that is coming out on Friday that covers essentially to the stars as they investigate UFOs. The main lead character in it is Luis Elizondo. It's a reality show. Of course, he used to run the Pentagon program, the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, ATIP. And so it also gets into cases that he looked at. Now, this all started, the fervor, of course, all of this started in December 2017 when Leslie Kane, Ralph Blumenthal, and Helen Cooper wrote this story about ATIP. And everybody's been really excited about it, but we haven't gotten a whole lot of information. And that has mostly been, I know for a fact, because of this television show. It was an idea of how do we get this information out there, for better or worse. A lot of people have criticized it, but those of us who have seen the program, like you and I, Martin, think that this program's really good, at least the first episode that we've seen. Mm-hmm. So this is how they decided to release this information. But people have been wondering what is going to be in the show. And there's been some interviews that we've all had to talk about what was in the show. Lou's dropped hints that other cases are going to be in there. And of course, when the New York Times article came out, there was a video in there. There were two FLIR videos, one of them from the 2004 Nimitz event. The other one, we didn't have much information. Then soon after, To the Stars released a third video. And there's a lot of debate over the last year or so. And did the DOD really release these videos? We do know that they did. Well, this all hit another huge, it's all making a big deal again right now, because the New York Times Well, for a couple articles. First, the Politico, they wrote Brian Bender, the guy working with Politico, who is actually in this new History Channel television show. He wrote an article about the Navy making new guidelines. Tom DeLonge, they came out and said that To the Stars influenced getting the new Navy to make UFO reporting guidelines. Chris Mellon then backed him up a little bit later in an article with George Knapp. And then some of us, such as yourself and myself, have spoken to one of the executive producers, Anthony LaPay. And he confirmed that not only did these guys have, you know, an influence with the Navy, but that is going to be in the show. We're going to actually see this influence and see Lou Elizondo and the other Two of the Stars guys working with the Navy to get all of this information out. So on top of that, there are also going to be some more exciting cases related to those other videos in the History Channel show. And the New York Times finally, you know, what, a year and a half later, has done a follow-up to their original ATIP article. And this one's called, their headlines are really weird, actually. Both articles, the headlines are weird. But the headlines in this is, wow, what is that?
Yes.
Navy pilots report unexplained flying objects.
I do agree about the headlines. I thought of that,
yeah,
too.
The other one was auroras and whatever. But this has a couple more pilots that are coming forward about events that took place in 2014 and 2015. So they're talking about these UFO sightings and, you know, essentially, I don't think these encounters that they're talking about here are necessarily as exciting as Fravor's personal account. However, they are talking about more credible accounts where they're chasing, essentially looking for objects that are showing up on radar. One case that they talk about is really exciting, where these two jets are flying along, and this jet and his wingman are about 100 feet apart, and some object zips in between them. And this actually was a pivotal moment. This happened, I think, in 2014 or 2015, early 2015. And up until this point, they weren't sure what these objects were that were showing up on radar. But once this thing zipped through in between them, then they really took it seriously for two reasons. One, because they were getting close. This was a near miss. They could have been hurt. And two, because the object was a cube inside of a circle. They describe it as like a clear beach ball with a cube inside of it. So it was extremely flipping odd. They even, some people have described it as kind of X-Files, as Tyler Rogaway from Warzone wrote about how it's X-File-like, because it's just so weird. So at that point, you know, they took it really seriously. And we've got a new story that came out just today, the Washington Post. This is a great title of this article, too. It's called, essentially, that UFOs are a big deal and now we can't... He says, UFOs exist, and everyone needs to adjust to that fact. And what's great about this article, it's a political writer, and he says, UFOs are not the same as aliens, that we don't know what UFOs are. They're unidentified. What's beautiful about that is all of us know that, but this has been a real hard sell. This has been hard to educate the mainstream and mainstream media on that point, because they always want to go to aliens. So it's great to see him writing that. And then just now, I just posted some videos that I got from History of interviews with these pilots that from that New York Times article. And these are small clips, about minute and a half, of these pilots talking about these encounters. And these are clips from the show from upcoming episodes. So really exciting stuff. One other story to plug my stories. I wrote another story that just came out yesterday. Oh, no, it just came out this morning in Den of Geek. But this was centered around why Tom DeLonge. I think a lot of people are seeing the previews for Unidentified, and they see Lou Elizondo, you know, this career intelligence guy. They show Chris Mellon, who was, you know, worked intelligence with, like, the deputy assistant to, you know, national intelligence. Crazy. Working at the White House and the Pentagon and everything. Steve Justice, a guy who worked for Lockheed Martin Skunk Works. These are the guys who built the SR-71. So you have all of these very highly credible people. What's with this rock star right in the middle of it?
Yeah.
Of course, a lot of us know who have been following this, and this is the gist of the article, is that none of this really would have happened without Tom DeLonge. And what's really funny is I wrote this article probably 2-3 weeks ago, but after this news, with not just the Navy changing their guidelines, with all of these Navy pilots coming forward and the mainstream taking this seriously, and it all comes back to Tom DeLonge. Really, Tom DeLonge. This might have happened maybe in the months from now or years from now as people kind of came out, but he was kind of the person who coalesced all this and brought everybody together and focused this effort. And Tom DeLonge deserves an immense amount of credit for all of this.
Yeah, as long as he stays off like Joe Rogan's show. You know,
yeah, as long as he still has some really crazy ideas. And I don't know about you, but I have a lot of people harassing me. Well, what about Tom? Tom said this and Tom said that. Yeah. And it's like, it's great, but what Tom says, we don't have anything corroborating. What Lou says, now we have a lot of government documents that have come out. DOD at first kind of claimed that Lou was inaccurate in some things, but it, you know, finally, recently, they've had to admit that no, Lou was right about all of these things, that ATIP was about UFOs, that they did release the videos. So Lou has a lot of corroborating evidence. All of these Navy guys have, you know, other pilots, radar, that they can back up their claims. So a lot of the more fringy kind of wild ideas that Tom DeLonge has have still really don't have any idea where he got some of those ideas. But nevertheless, this crazy rock star guy is rocking through UFO world. Oh, what a great title. Rockstar rocking the UFO world.
There'll be a song. You know, you got to give credit where credit's due.
Exactly.
And I think, you know, there's a lot of people that really, really do not want to give Tom DeLonge any credit at all. And I kind of get that. The reason I kind of get that is because, you know, he comes out of nowhere, basically, and there's people who have been working really hard, you know, perhaps their entire life, trying to, you know, get some headway here.
And I've been at it a couple decades. I've spent Lord knows how much money.
And he just kind of, you know, I don't want to say he fell into it, but maybe he did fall into it. It kind of, but it,
you know,
without
his
celebrity status, he would have never gone anywhere, really, with that.
You know what? I think that you've got a great point there, because in a way, I think he did. It's not just his celebrity status. He was wise enough to go to the right place. You know, somebody keeps sending us notes, but I think that the person who's sending us notes doesn't have everything right. But in a way, they do. I think that, you know, they're mentioning like Hal Puthoff, who's part of the group, which is true. That Hal Puthoff is part of the group and has been very helpful. Kit Green has worked in this field. But the point being, at Robert Bigelow, a lot of this comes back to all of this group of researchers and very credible people who have worked inside of government to make the paranormal serious, to make people pay attention to the credible evidence towards different paranormal aspects, decades, and now really with the help of Tom DeLonge and kind of a more of a coalescing and a team kind of atmosphere among all of these people, and help from people like Leslie Kane and Ralph Blumenthal, who write these articles for the New York Times, we've got this perfect storm situation where it's all coming together now with the History Channel show. And people are going to have to take our word for it that the History Channel's good, show is good. And I don't blame them. In my review, I wrote, I could see how you'd be skeptical, especially when History Channel's doing Ancient Aliens, and this show's coming right after Ancient Aliens.
Yeah.
But it's much, much different than Ancient Aliens, and you can attest to that.
Yeah, I have only watched Ancient Aliens a couple of times in my life, so, and it was a long time ago, so I can't really remember much about it, only Tsoukalos's hair. You know,
but, well, that kind of speaks volumes, though, because you're into this topic, yet you're not that big of a fan of Ancient Aliens. And I'm in the same boat. I love Giorgio. I love the guys who are in the show. They're personal friends, many of them. But that's really not my cup of tea so much. However, Unidentified is. It's hard-hitting evidence and facts, Navy pilots, jet fighters, exciting stuff.
Yeah, great stuff. Excellent. Well, Alejandro, thank you so much. Yeah, and it's really, you know, the news is breaking daily, it seems.
It is. I mean, it's keeping me so busy. It's I think it's breaking even, you know, throughout the day. Even today's been so hot with several great stories, and now these videos that I literally just posted before coming on with you. So
yeah,
it's exciting stuff.
So check out. Is it at your own channel? What's the name of your channel?
Most of this news you can find at openminds.tv, and I'll have this article up there soon. But otherwise, you can also find it at on my social media. Alejandro T. Rojas is my Twitter, or also AlejandroTRojas.com.
Excellent. All right, Alejandro, thanks so much, and I'll be talking to you next week.
All right. Talk to you later.
Have a
thanks,
good
man.
One. Thank you. All right, our guest this evening, pretty excited about talking about this subject, and it's Dr. Michael P. Masters, and he is a professor of biological anthropology at Montana Tech in Butte, Montana. He received a PhD in anthropology from The Ohio State University in 2009, where he specialized in human evolutionary anatomy, archaeology, and biomedicine. His new book is called Identified Flying Objects, a Multidisciplinary Scientific Approach to the UFO Phenomena. Challenges readers to consider the new possibilities while cultivating conversations about our ever-evolving understanding of time and time travel. And this is why he's on, to cultivate a conversation. Welcome to the show, Dr. Masters.
Thanks, Martin. It's so great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Yes, yeah. So I guess I'm going to start out by asking you to talk about your background and kind of what made you decide to take a look at this this whole idea of yours.
Well, it all started when I was a small child. I was about 8 years old and overheard a conversation that my parents were having with some friends that were over at our house. And I remember creeping down the stairs and kind of sitting up on the stairs and listening. And it was this crazy story about this glowing ball of light that my father saw a short period of time before I was born. And described it as this glowing orb sitting across the horizon in a very dark part of Ohio, in Amish country, and said it shot toward the truck. Him and someone, a colleague that were riding along with him that night, both observed the same thing. Sat there for a little bit, shot back across the horizon, hovered there for a while, and then went straight up. And that really piqued my interest and made me want to learn more about it.
Wow. And did he ever try to, try to decide what he thought he saw? I mean, did the word UFO actually come out? What did he think he saw?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think he was really confused, as are most people that have an experience like that. He did try to get some level of understanding. What was really formative for me personally was that he got Whitley Strieber's book, Communion, and I remember seeing it up on the shelf in our living room and kind of had this mental image that I describe early in the book as just kind of a chimpanzee in early hominin form, a modern human form, and then this archetypal alien form with a big head, big eyes, small face, and whatnot. And just it sort of made me wonder if there could be some sort of phylogenetic evolutionary connection there. And that's what set me down this path. But he really didn't talk about it much. I remember actually having to ask him about it. I think I was in college, maybe a sophomore, junior in college, and sat down just because I was really starting to look into this more and wanted to get a take on his personal experiences. But other than that little sit down we had many years ago, it really wasn't something he brought up or discussed willingly. Kind of took some prodding to get him to even describe his personal experience. But I know he was certainly interested in trying to get more information, because when you see something like that, there's really no way to just ignore it. I think everybody, it's a life-changing thing, and people really want some explanation or at least some answers for what that might have been.
Yeah, that's actually why I'm here.
Is it really?
Experience
you
I
had.
Yeah.
What was yours?
It was it's by most people's sightings. I have to tell you, it was boring. I was in basically in a hot tub, and something caught my eye. It was in Carmel Valley, California, back in 2006, something caught my eye. I've told this story a number of times, so listener, bear with me here. And so I looked up, and it was sort of dusk. You know, it wasn't really nightfall. And I saw this perfectly shaped disc. I would say it's like probably the size of, it's hard to say, look like the size of a quarter, I guess. I don't know exactly how high up it was. And it had like a light blue glow and no lights or anything. And it moved and silently. And that was the thing that freaked me out the most, is like, wow, there's no noise. This thing is, yeah, you know, not a single noise. And then it just stopped and then went off at an angle toward Carmel. I'm sorry, toward Monterey. So I jumped out of the hot tub and called. I didn't know of any reporting centers or anything like that. Never even dawned on me to look online or anything.
Right.
And so I called the police department and said, is anyone else seeing this? And I was put on hold for about 20 minutes and gave up. So it's kind of a boring sighting.
Oh, man. But, no, I don't think so at all. In fact, I haven't seen anything. So to me, that's phenomenal. That's a really great experience and a cool place to see it too. I actually just came from Monterey last week. I was there as part of a book tour I was on, and so beautiful area.
Oh, isn't it? Yeah, it was really nice. I've lived out that way for I think it was 9 years. So the thing I'm coming up with, did your father actually see an entity of some type?
No, just okay. the light, and it was the same thing. There weren't lights on it. He described it as glowing, as just not radiating beams of light, mm-hmm. As they do when you look at a bright light in the dark, street light or whatever, but just sort of a glow that it had.
Yeah.
But no, I don't think it was any sort of presence of a being or any sort of communication or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we're going to be talking about time travel, the possibility of it, and this is what your book kind of, I believe, the basis of it, the possible basis of it. And you know, as a kid, I remember I used to make a lot of stupid jokes, and one of them was, well, we'll never invent time travel because we never see anyone from the future. But I think your book kind of is questioning that.
It addresses that specifically. That was always Stephen Hawking's principal argument too, is that because we're not inundated with time tourists, it must mean that time travel will never be possible.
Yeah. One of the things I was thinking about, and I wanted to tell you your thoughts on this, is I had an astrobiologist on this show, astrophysicist on the show a number of years ago, and Jeffrey, I just can't think of his last name right now, and he said that him and his colleagues at NASA, he was a senior visiting scientist at NASA, and he said they would kind of talk, you know, quietly. And one of the things, you know, about the possibility of, you know, space travel and all that. And one of the things they, you know, that they kind of bounced off each other is that if a civilization can get through the bottleneck of technology without blowing themselves up, then they would be traveling the stars. And so right. I wanted to get your feedback on that phrase.
Yeah, I mean, that was a big part of the Drake equation, too. I think one of the most important variables is L in his equation, is how long does a civilization exist? How long can they persist after they reach that point when they develop complex societies and politics and economics and war? And it does seem like there would be some sort of intrinsic bottleneck associated with that. In looking at humanity on this planet, and that is currently our only frame of reference, since we don't have other visitors from other planets coming here and interacting with us openly and telling us what's going on their own planet. But here, yeah, we've been a very warmongering species for a long time, and there have been very peaceful societies throughout history and prehistory, but they tend to not last very long, or have been driven to the outskirts by agricultural groups, especially up to the Neolithic Revolution and the dawn of agriculture. And yeah, ever since then, as I tell my anthropology classes, anytime humans have developed technology to kill each other better, that technology and those people spread very rapidly. You see it with the Copper Age, Iron Age, Gunpowder Age, and now with the potential to completely wipe ourselves out, or at least to really damage the human population and the earth that we live on with nuclear war. Yeah, it really makes you think about that and contemplate how important that might be. What if we did create a true bottleneck, both genetically, technologically? It set us back tremendously in all of the progress that's brought us to where we are today. I definitely think that's important to consider.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're right at our break right now. It's the first time this has happened.
When in doubt, keep going, I guess.
Yeah. I think of a number of things, and, you know, you've heard, you know, the fear of artificial intelligence, you know, I mean, what that can do in the future. I mean, you know, you could create a machine that says destroy the world and, you know, keep creating new machines to destroy the world and, you know, and then it can get out of control, you know, but that's kind of like, you know, maybe that's a little way out there, but I mean,
it's been a theme in so many science fiction films, and a lot of times those are based in real fears, real possibilities. I could certainly see where there might be the potential for that. You'd think as humans we would tame it once it got to the point where maybe that could potentially happen. And a lot of it comes down to consciousness too, and this idea of free will. And there may be more to it than just the robots decide to do this. But no, it's definitely something. Who was it? I think Elon Musk came out recently and warned us of that, and a couple other high level executives, smart people. Certainly very intelligent and connected people. So yeah, when people like Elon Musk say we should be afraid of that, I definitely sit up and listen.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So if one of the things I have said many times on this show, also when talking with people that had different ideas on, you know, what possibly could UFOs be, I always say a lot of times that we often think in terms of human terms, and it's so hard to, and that comes to everything, even down to physics. You know, we think of, well, they can't get here from there because it is extremely vast. I mean, you can't even comprehend the vastness of from one star to another and all that. So I understand that, but I also understand that we are thinking in human terms. We're thinking of terms of what we know, and we don't know if everything has been thought of in physics. It's most likely not. So what were your thoughts that kind of led you on the path of possible time travel instead of visitors?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And humans have a tremendous knack for anthropomorphizing things and ascribing human characteristics. It's really all we know. We can't sit down with dolphins and have these conversations about dolphin points of view or chimpanzee points of view. We're kind of alone in our intellect, at least with regard to these higher level cognition types of things. But for me personally, the main thing is the physiology, the physical characteristics, and looking at long-term evolutionary changes in the hominid lineage. And two of the main changes that characterize us as humans and hominins, which is just us and our upright walking ancestors, going back to the split between us and eventually what became the chimpanzee, which was about 6 to 8 million years ago, when we shared a common ancestor. But the two main changes have to do with our brains increasing in size and expanding laterally from the inside out, but also forward and coming out over top of our eyeballs. And in fact, we're the only mammal that has that craniofacial configuration in which our forebrain sits right on top of our eye orbits. And the trade-off there is that our faces have to get out of the way. It would be like putting a camper trailer on top of a Corvette and expecting that to work out logistically. It's just, and it's the same thing with craniofacial morphology. You can see it very clearly in dogs, as an example, a Doberman Pinscher or a Collie versus a Pug or even a Rottweiler, larger dogs that still have those retract faces and larger foreheads. So over evolutionary time, and especially more recently in recent human evolution, the last 800,000 years or so, our brains have continued this increase in size, but also a change in shape. They've become what we as anthropologists call globular, an increase in globularity, where they become more rounded, more balloon-like, or we become more bubble-headed, essentially. And our faces continue to get out of the way of this runaway brain. And it's not just that morphology, but it's also given us this evolution in our culture. Going back 3.3 million years ago with the advent of the first stone tools, that set in motion this accelerating rate of change in our culture and technology as well. And the phones that we have, any sort of machinery, computers, all of it is the direct descendants of those first stone tools 3 million years ago. And so if we look at time in the sense of deep time and human evolution, both culturally and biologically, you can really see this consistent pattern, these tenacious trends, both in our morphology and culture. And projecting those forward, you would get something that very much resembles the most commonly described alien form, or what I refer to as an extratempestrial in the book, replacing terre, the Latin root for earth, with tom, the root for time. So even without making claims or speculating about what might happen if we did blow ourselves up and there was nuclear war and we had to live in space or underground, without even going down that speculative road, just looking at the continuation of these same enduring trends throughout hominin evolution into the future, you would expect to get something very similar to what's commonly described in these reports of close encounters.
Wow, wow. I just found out that we are on break.
Oh, no.
KGRA. But that's okay. This is
all
still going to be...
All of that was moot.
No, that's okay. It's all going to be on YouTube and on my podcast, so it's all good. It's all good. But we're going back in half a minute from now. We'll just continue on with the conversation. That's all we can do at this point because I wasn't prepared for that. So,
no worries. I'll try to work some of that back in at some point because I do think it's important to understanding the argument.
Yeah.
And the holistic aspects of the argument.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm just going to break here for just a second. Race, you want to count us back in? Race, are you there? Okay.
I wanted the mic, but I had the mute button.
There you are.
Sorry.
Okay.
We're ready to go?
Yeah, we're ready.
In
here.
5, 4, 3, 2.
All right. Welcome back. My guest is Dr. Michael Masters. And during the break, we were talking about how the evolution is possible. And can you kind of just go, since we didn't realize we were on a break here, I don't want to repeat the same thing right over again, but can you kind of give like a nutshell of what you were saying just so to catch the people up over there at KGRA Radio?
Yeah, no problem. In instructing and being a professor, we have to give Cliff Notes versions of things all the time. So, yeah, the bottom line is after we stood upright, after we became bipedal about 6 to 8 million years ago, one of the main changes that results from that, and I actually didn't mention this in the break, so it adds new content to what was just mentioned, is that our heads have to rotate down. In order to see where we're going, our heads have to come forward to keep our eyes in line with the horizon. And quadrupedal animals don't have that requirement.
Hmm.
So we stood upright, our heads rotated down, and that created a flexing of our cranial base. So the anterior cranial base, that area where the forebrain sits right on top of the eye orbits, came down, and the foramen magnum, the big hole where our spinal cord passes to connect with our brain, rotated downward and forward in association with their heads rotating down. And that, really more than anything else, is a big part of why we grew such large brains in the first place. It created what's called cranial flexing. You can think of bending two ends of a slinky down toward each other. It creates this bowing on the top and this more bulbous characteristic that is essentially what our brains look like. So beyond any of the other changes that took place in hominin evolution, really just standing upright was a big catalyst for the development of these larger brains, more retracted faces, more intelligence. You certainly have to add to that the free use of our hands. We're not using our arms and our hands to walk around anymore. Rather, we can use them to make tools and to communicate and to do things that we couldn't do if they're burdened with locomotion. So really standing upright set in motion a number of important changes that really contributed to the uniqueness of modern humans and a lot of the unique traits of our ancestors as well.
Now, I know, I understand. I've read quite a bit just for my own interest in, you know, Neanderthals. And now they're, you know, with recent discoveries, they believe that they were actually cooking with fire, which is pretty amazing. And
that goes way back. 1.8 million years ago, we see the first evidence.
And that's also
Homo erectus.
Oh, wow. And that also adds to intelligence too, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And the trade-off I was mentioning between our brain size and our facial size, our face had to get out of the way of our expanding brains. And by cooking our food, it helped with a number of things. It made the food safer to eat. It cooked off bacteria and parasites and viruses and things. But it also reduced selective pressure to maintain big teeth and a big chewing apparatus, or masticatory muscles, as we call them. So it allowed a reduction in the face because of culture that allowed the brain to continue expanding. And that's why in anthropology we talk about biocultural evolution. We can't really separate those. There's many things about our physiology that are the direct result of our culture, and many things in our culture that are influenced by our biology. So we really look at them as the synergy, this relationship that's inseparable in looking at the long history of human evolution on this planet.
Well, modern humans. Now, that's always baffled me because, you know, they say modern humans doesn't appear that they've been around that long, and as far as it's in the hundreds of thousands of years, and it's just baffling to me. Where do you see, I think I read somewhere in some of your literature or whatever, there's no such thing as a missing link anymore. So do you want to tackle that a little, you know, talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. If somebody says something about a missing link, that's an instant red flag. It's sort of an archaic idea, mostly an attempt to refute evolutionary change or human evolutionary change specifically. But no, at this point we have a very, very good understanding of our evolutionary history. As I mentioned, going back to that time when we first started walking upright about 6 to 8 million years ago. And a big part of my research is looking at those evolutionary changes. And there are places where there's not as much information, beginning with our own genus. Homo habilis is one of the best examples. We have a number of skulls, bones, and they were some of the first to use stone tools. So we have a lot of information, but it's all relative. But there is no point that we just don't know what was going on. And I think a big part of that comes down to, for some people, it's a desire to not understand it, or to try to find some reason to criticize it, even though it's an outdated idea. But it's also that there's a disconnect between what we do as scientists and where we publish, and then what is released in more mainstream media outlets. And that's just an aspect of science in general, is that we write for each other the vast majority of time in order to communicate new things, new discoveries, to have really detailed arguments about the morphology of this hominin and how it fits in with these other ones, and should it be a different species or classified as the same species. But the general public is left out of that conversation because it's very esoteric and it's complicated speech. But you do have stories come out. There's big finds. And one thing I try to do with this book is to really explain things in understandable terms, and to present not just an argument about what or who, rather, these aliens might be, these extraterrestrials, but also to really give people a deep understanding of human origins and of human evolution and of cultural evolution and what things really got us to where we are today, and tie it into all of this. But it would be impossible to read this book, I think, and to walk away without a much deeper knowledge of anthropology, astrobiology, astronomy, and physics, because I really try to do a science communication thing and really convey in real understandable terms what we can learn from each of these fields and how it applies to this UFO phenomenon.
Hmm. I remember reading something in a dentist's office or something, an article, I forget what magazine it was in, but it was saying that, you know, they think within, you know, I forget, about 1,000 years or something like that, that most people will have more of a darker complexion and, you know, dark hair and all that. What would be the basis of, you know, I don't know if you've ever heard that as well, but what would be the basis for thoughts of that? I mean, how can someone judge where we're heading, or is it just by the subtle things that you've have repeated in the past?
Yeah, that's a sticky wicket, really. I try to stay away from those types of conjectures in my own research because there really is no way to know it. So many little things like that, especially stature, height, weight, different characteristics that are already so variable among humans, like skin color, and that have a long evolutionary history associated with them, those tend to also respond to environmental variables. And without knowing what those environmental variables are going to be in the proximate or distant future, it's much harder to say what those traits would be or would look like. I touch on them a little bit in the book in the context of current cultural trends. There is a tendency to whitewash. A lot of people with darker skin try to lighten their skin, but at the same time, a lot of people with light skin spend a lot of money and a lot of time and put themselves at risk for skin cancer and trying to darken their skin too. So there's a number of things that play into that issue of skin color. I do talk a little bit about the self-domestication process, and one of the things that happens as we domesticate other animals and as we domesticate ourselves, because beginning with agriculture, we've started domesticating ourselves as well, is that you have a reduction in pigmentation. And so in looking at this commonly reported characteristic in close encounters where the being was actually seen or an individual was abducted, they often report a sort of grayish looking skin. And that doesn't exist in humans. We don't have gray skin. We have brown skin and black skin and white skin and everything in between. And if you did average out the skin tone of the whole human population, it would sort of be a brownish color. And that could potentially be what they were talking about in that article, is more of an averaging or a homogenization of these genes that code for skin color. But even outside of that, and domesticating ourselves, we may start to just reduce pigmentation in general, which over time could potentially result in those characteristics, a grayish color skin without all of the melanocytes firing off melanin and creating the brown skin color, just a sort of a pale grayish color that lacks pigmentation. But again, that's rooted in things we've already shown experimentally with other animals. So there's a little bit more of a basis for arguments like that, rather than saying that we'll have more sun or less ozone. We can't know those things for sure. So I do try to stay away from those as much as possible in my own research.
Now, a number of things I've thought of over the years or whatever is, you know, we're a rare solar system where we only have one sun. You know, a lot of solar systems have, you know, more than one sun. There's all these different things that play into with how we evolved. And so it's always been curious to me to wonder how something could evolve on another planet. The variables of oxygen or breathable air or whatever it is they can learn to breathe, the weight of the planet, gravity. Mm-hmm. That's a major part in the development of something. And something as simple as a moon or not having a moon with the tides and things like that are all stepping stones to how we got here. And is that just some of the variables on evolution and how we, you know, crawled out of the water, basically?
Yeah, but those are certainly important ones. A binary star system would really complicate the formation of life in different ways. It can certainly happen, but its evolutionary trajectory would certainly be very different than our own. And yeah, you're right. The chemistry, the climate, the distance from the sun, the amount of water, the amount of ice, the moon, all of those things are important. I'm really glad you mentioned gravity, too, because that's one that I talk about a lot in the book, is we suffer a lot of maladies associated with our upright form of walking, bipedal locomotion, as we call it. And we're one of few mammals that does it habitually. Most animals are quadrupedal, walking on all four. So the fact that we have things like herniated discs, fractured discs, blown out knees, hemorrhoids, hernias, just all kinds of problems with our knees, ankles, hips, broken hips, and older age with osteoporosis. All of these things indicate that we are at the upper limit of what a planet might be able to sustain with regard to bipedalism. And we're only at 9.8 meters per second squared. And an argument I make in the book is that most of the planets that have been found as part of the Kepler mission are far heavier than Earth. I think only about 2.2, 2.7, I forget the exact number, but somewhere under 3% of them are much larger than Earth, which would really make it prohibitive for an upright walking humanoid form to evolve. And a big part of what I was talking about earlier, before, during, I guess a little bit after the break, is that bipedalism was so important for us becoming what we are today, having the ability to sit down and have these conversations in different parts of the country. I can't see you. You can't see me. Well, I guess we can through Skype, which also is a testament to our success. But we have all of these technologies and these abilities that really are either directly or indirectly the result of our bipedalism. So in looking at all of this variability in size across these different planets, even taking out of the equation the chemistry and the climate and the binary or one-star systems, we still aren't likely to have bipedalism on those planets, and we aren't likely to have this humanoid form. So even looking at the other reports of mantis men and insect-like humanoids and reptilians, they're still almost universally described as being bipedal, and that's just not something you would expect to see based on the current data coming out of the Kepler mission.
Interesting. Never would think of that. And I know we're going to get into all of that topic. We're coming up in about 7 minutes on the next break. And so is evolution, I mean, this has always been kind of fascinating to me. It's very, very slow. It seems to be very, very slow. I know, they've done studies in like the Galapagos Islands, the different islands, the same bird changed. A lot of it had to do with the food and environment and all that. But how slow is, first of all, is part of evolution, can part of evolution be a freak of nature? Like, someone that is all of a sudden born differently and then they, proceed to have children and that change happens like that? Or is it just very, very always known to be extremely slow and very subtle? How does that work?
Well, it really depends on the reproductive time of the organism. So one of the reasons why we're constantly having to develop new drugs to combat diseases that we've evolved with over many millennia is because they evolve much faster than we do. So if you have, for instance, influenza is a good example, because each year we have to identify which strain of influenza is going to be the dominant one. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they get it wrong, as it turns out, and then we have a different strain and the vaccine is completely useless. But the reason we have to do that is because it's constantly evolving. It's evolving very, very quickly because viruses evolve very rapidly. You take a petri dish and subject bacteria to these strong environmental conditions. You add radiation or a lot of solvents, and they're going to evolve very quickly. We've created many really interesting forms of Drosophila, fruit flies. A lot of our early genetics data and understanding of the double helix came from research that was done with these fruit flies, and the main reason is because they have a very rapid reproductive cycle. Mm-hmm. They don't live very long. They reproduce, I think it's just a couple of days or something like that. Mm-hmm. So those organisms evolve very quickly. Us, with it taking until puberty, age 12, 13, and in modern times we typically wait even longer to reproduce, it is a much slower process as seen by us. Obviously, you know, if you asked a sloth or a tortoise, they'd probably think we look like the Drosophila. And if you asked Drosophila, they'd think it was incredibly slow and they'd be dead before they even finished that thought, because they are born and die so quickly. But it really just comes down to the organism and also the environment. Like I mentioned, if you were subjecting those organisms to a very strong selective pressure, they're going to evolve very quickly. So it's both of those things. And yeah, as you point out, those freaks of nature mostly result from mutations. And if there's a mutation that's beneficial and that individual is able to make more babies relative to other individuals that don't have that mutation, and then their offspring also have it and they make more babies, you're very quickly going to see that trait spread throughout the population and over subsequent generations. If that trait's a negative characteristic, and especially if it kills that individual before reproductive age, it's not going to show up anywhere. It dies with that individual. So yeah, those freaks of nature, those random things that happen, are really an important part of evolution and understanding the evolutionary process.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that, you know, the lifespans have changed dramatically, you know, even over the last 400 years. You know, I mean, you think of the 30s were the average age of, you know, due to all different types of reasons. And so, and like you said, you know, the children were, I mean, basically, there was childbirth at, you know, 14, 12, and, you know, all that.
Right.
So, but other than, I know that, you know, like I've seen armor from knights from, you know, the 1500s and Middle Ages or whatever, and they're very small, you know, I mean, very short, and for the most part. But other than height and things like that, have we been able to record in human, you know, recorded human history, any type of changes in development of our species?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I know we're coming up on a break, so I'll keep it pretty short. But yeah, you're right. Height's a diachronic thing, and you can easily see whenever there's one of the first studies I worked on in grad school looked at this. Whenever you have a recession or a depression or a war, height drops tremendously and then starts to come back up. Yeah, no, it's one of the main variables we use in bioarchaeological analyses. When we dig up past cemeteries, there was a big study at Ohio State that looked at pre-agricultural and post-agricultural populations. And just after agriculture, that same thing happened. Our health deteriorated. We started having all kinds of new problems, diseases. But one of the biggest indicators is our size. Our height decreased tremendously, as it did with other animals that we were trying to domesticate. So, there's quite a few of those. Malaria is an important one, another biocultural example where we started to live in places with standing pools of water and without the trees that other animals inhabit. And we started to evolve sickle cell alleles, sickle cell anemia, which in itself is a negative thing, but in a malarial environment, it actually protects you against malaria. So there's quite a few changes like that. And I mentioned a number of them in the book that are associated with more recent evolutionary changes, things that you can identify that have happened in very recent human history.
I wonder if we're going to, I was in a cafe yesterday and I happened to look out, and the whole entire cafe, everyone in that cafe was looking down at their phone, every single person. And I thought, I wonder if we're going to develop somehow, if our bodies are going to develop to change the cell phone. We're right at the break, so we're going to come back right after these messages. Everyone, hang in there. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Alrighty, welcome back. This is Martin Willis with Podcast UFO, and my guest is Dr. Michael P. Masters, and we're having a very interesting conversation. We haven't really got into what these things possibly are yet, and I'm heading that way just to let you know, if you're the listener. We're going to take calls in about a half an hour or so from now, so that number is going to be the same as always. Next week, we should have a call screening set in place with a different phone number. That number will be announced. And I did want to tell the listener that if anyone wants to jump over at the International UFO Congress website, that's ufocongress.com, there is a code you can put in there. That's IUFOC. That's IUFOC. See, that's like a UFO with an I in front of it and a C after it. And put in that code and you'll get $30 off if you want to get a ticket for the International UFO Congress coming up this September. I can't wait. I'll be there as usual, and it'll be a lot of fun. And so will our guest, Dr. Michael Masters, will be there. That will be really nice to meet you in person.
Absolutely. I'm really looking forward to that. I think it's going to be a really great event. I'd also like to mention that I thought Alejandro's news segment was tremendously fascinating. Really informative, and it was super fun to listen to.
Oh, that's great. I'm glad. I'll give him that feedback. He does. He's, you know, there's not too many people in the topic as deeply as he is, and it's a lot of fun. He's a good guy. We haven't really touched on the possible things that people are seeing, possibly time travels, yet. We're going to get into that some more, but a couple more questions I had for you is you have heard what people have described as what they're seeing in these abduction sequences. You mentioned the grays. That's one typical. There's a lot of different ones that people are saying, a different species or whatever, and you know, and I'm on the fence about all that stuff because I don't really know, you know. But do you think that we are on the path of evolution to head toward a species with the characteristics that you're seeing? They always talk about the large eyes. They always talk about the little slit for the mouth, thin body, small in stature mostly. This is what a lot of people are reporting. I don't know if you've ever listen to any of the Ariel School incident in South Africa. But that, you know, they describe very well on what they saw and similar aspects, but skin like porcelain. And, you know, just there's been so many accounts. So the question, I know I'm rambling here, but do you see like a trend of evolution going in any of these directions slowly?
Yeah, absolutely. That's really a big focus of the book, I think, is to really focus on what we can know now. And looking back our evolutionary past, we can see these changes taking place. And we have a very good record of them. And we have very good means with which to study them, primarily through CT scans and endocasts and MRI, which is something I've used in my own research quite a lot. If you look at these evolutionary changes in our own lineage here on Earth, projecting those forward, you would get something very, very similar to what is so ubiquitously reported in these accounts. And I break it down into more concrete terms and talk about what specifically has led to our brains growing larger and our faces growing smaller. And even trying to address things like telepathy that's so commonly reported, mm-hmm. and what might contribute to that over evolutionary time, and looking at modern research into brain-to-brain interaction and different evolutionary trends related to the reduction of our face and how that could impact vocalization over the long term. So I very much took time to research numerous abduction accounts and other close encounters of the fourth and fifth kind in which these beings were observed, or people claim to have observed them. And like I tell people all the time, if they were consistently describing some ten-legged squid-like monster creature, I never would have written this book. But the fact that they so often, so consistently are described as hominins. I mean, if you look at the form of these organisms, and the average, say, even taking into account the reptile-like, insect-like, but even if you average them all out, what you get is something that if you put them next to us and our hominoid relatives, the chimpanzee, orangutan, gorilla, all of the different primates, there's no question that they would be considered a hominin. They have all of the characteristics that we have. And like I said earlier, we fight a lot about what traits should be used to classify a specific species or a specific genus within our own human evolutionary history. But looking at this form that's so commonly reported and described in these accounts, there's absolutely no question. And something that came up, I gave a talk at a MUFON meeting in Oregon just last week, 2 weeks ago, and something that came up were hybrids. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned to them, mm-hmm. Well, I mentioned to them that if you believe that we are hybridizing with these extra tempestrials, as I call them, then you have to acknowledge that they are human. because that's the definition of a species. The biological criteria of species classification is that if two organisms can mate with each other and produce viable offspring, meaning that offspring itself is able to reproduce, then by definition they are the same species. So if you believe that we are hybridizing with these aliens in whatever capacity you understand them, you have to admit that they are human simply because that's the criteria we use to define humanness and to define a species. So there's a lot of traits even beyond that that I think are really important to consider. And the point of the book, in addition to looking at questions of what extraterrestrial life might look like on other planets and the question of time and time travel and the cosmos writ large, the main focus of the book, or at least a principal focus of the book, is what have we done? What has happened to us? How have we evolved over the last 6 to 8 million years? And what's that going to look like going forward? Just if we project those same things forward, and it's hard to argue that it wouldn't look like what's being described in these encounters.
Has all of these different thoughts are going through my mind as you're speaking. And one of them is, you know, I talked about earlier the bottleneck of technology. It's possible we could wipe ourselves out and start over again. I mean, if time is, you know, if we have enough time left before the sun swells up and burns everything on Earth, we have time to evolve again, possibly. But I don't know. I'm going off on that one. But one of the things I was thinking about is, you talked about telepathy, and a lot of people have reported kind of something that kind of fits with what you're talking about, I would have to say. A lot of people report of take care of your planet. You know, they're mm-hmm. along those lines. Like, you know, you hear about that, and I mentioned, you know, the Ariel school.
Very, very commonly.
Yeah, yeah. So that kind of fits with your thoughts. But another thing that comes to mind is like the butterfly effect. You know, don't change anything because one little subtle change may wipe out the fact that you even exist. So what were your, how did you get into any of that stuff? Or did into any of that?
Oh, absolutely. We dive very, very deep into that part of the swimming pool. Yeah. I'd like to circle back to something you just said, though, is that if a big part of this model, and what I think is important, especially for your scientific listeners or your listeners that are involved in the scientists, is to understand, is that it is a testable hypothesis. It's falsifiable. And as you mentioned, even if we wipe ourselves out, we've still tested this model. We by definition, we would become them. And at that point at which we do, or at whatever point they decide to let us in on this, we would understand this. We would know this. We could search the heavens for millennia trying to find organisms on other planets that fit our hominin form and just keep looking. But at some point, we would eventually become them under this model. And I think that's an important thing to mention. And like you said, yeah, why would they constantly be telling us, take care of your planet, or warning us about nuclear weapons? Or why would there be so many reports during major historic events like World War II and the Foo Fighters, or with all of the sightings over major historic, prehistoric sites? All of those things just make more sense in the context of future humans investigating their past, or possibly even tourism. Like Hawking always said, what we started this conversation with earlier is that because we're not inundated with time tourists, means time travel must not exist. And I counter that by saying we're probably seeing them all the time, and that's what the UFO phenomenon is, or at least a big part of it. So I think it's important to also acknowledge those things. But yeah, no, the big part, I would say, as I just mentioned, the first major focus of this book is on our evolutionary anatomy and what links our past to our present and our present to our presumed future. But the other big part is time. You can't talk about time and time travel in the context of this phenomenon without providing a very detailed account of our current understanding of what time is or how backward time travel may be achieved. So a big section throughout the middle of the book focuses on the history of our understanding of time and what time means cross-culturally. It's really interesting to look at how other cultures perceive time or don't at all. Some societies don't have any word or any verbs that describe actions in the past or the future. Just acknowledging that variation in our understanding or perception of time, and then really getting into how physicists understand time. Historians and logicians and philosophers would probably argue with this to some extent, but physicists are in the best position to really understand what time is. And they and engineers and people in material sciences are probably going to be the most instrumental in actually developing a time machine. So I really turn to modern physics research, research in quantum mechanics with regard to not just how we might achieve backward time travel, and I go into great detail about that and looking at early research in this with Van Stockham and Gödel and Tipler and modern research that's come from that, much of which, really all of which, started with Einstein and his general relativity model and different solutions to his field equations. So I go deep into that, but then also get into what you're talking about. You know, what happens if we travel through time? And the big questions always center around paradoxes, the grandfather paradox, mm-hmm. and other consistency paradoxes. And you see these in television and movies all the time. Many books really look at time travel in obscure terms and fantasy terms. But what I found that I have to do oftentimes in talking about this book and talking about modern physics research into this question is correct a lot of those assumptions that people have that they've gotten from things like Back to the Future or Futurama or any other show that talks about the future. Futurama, they actually do a great job. They really acknowledge paradoxes and try to stay consistent with it. And they have, I think collectively, they had 50 years at Harvard and master's and PhD wow. programs, the writers on that show. It's a very good show, and they do a great job. But there are a lot of others that don't have that expertise to draw from. And so I find that I often am addressing those things and those questions that relate to the paradoxes. And you're right, the butterfly effect is a big one. And it's important to acknowledge, though, that the main idea or the consensus among physicists is that time and space exist as one giant entity,
yeah.
what they refer to as block time or landscape time, or the block universe is something that you oftentimes hear, where all moments, all events that ever existed or will exist from the beginning of the Big Bang to the end of time when all matter is sucked up into black holes or however it happens, exist as one static block of space-time. And we, as cognizant organisms, biological beings, move through that, and it feels like we do so linearly. We perceive these events that exist as part of the static block universe as a sequential series of events. So we have this entrenched idea of an arrow of time, or linear time, which really is kind of a false sense of how things work. Almost everything in physics is time reversible. It's time neutral. It makes just as much sense running from future to past as it does from past to future. But we see things as progressing in this way. So a lot of those issues related to the butterfly effect and consistency paradoxes just have to do with our entrenched view of linear time, rather than being some violation of the physical laws of the universe. So I think it's important to make that distinction. And then I really dive into what's referred to as the Novikov self-consistency principle. He was a Russian physicist. He was really instrumental and continues to be instrumental in providing clarity on these issues and helping us understand how the future can dictate events in the past, given that the future, present, and past are all one. If you understand it in the context of this block universe and block time, then none of them are ahead of or behind each other in the presence of a time machine. Once you have a time machine and the ability to travel through the block universe, there is no past to future causality any longer. And this has actually recently been demonstrated with some experiments in physics, looking at Wheeler's-Gedanken models and things that are probably not something I should go into now because they're pretty complex, and I probably put people to sleep with it. But the main takeaway here is that visiting the past, it's non-disruptive. So anything resulting from someone visiting the past, interacting with the past, already occurred before that person ever left from the future to go to the past. It's always a part of it. So there's an inherent self-consistency that's maintained across these different slices of block time. So we don't have to worry about a butterfly effect. We don't have to worry about a new parallel universe popping out or the universe having to correct itself when we travel into the past, because it's already self-correcting. There's already self-consistency inherent across the block universe.
Wow. This is really fascinating to me. I was going to mention, I was going to talk about parallel universe possibilities and other dimensions and all that. But I wanted to, you know, when you were talking about time in the very beginning back there, it reminded me of, I had a great science teacher in high school, and he said on a Friday afternoon, he said, okay, your assignment for this weekend is to come back with a full definition of time. And then he turned around. And I remember, you know, I really, it was a fascinating, Monday was a fascinating day. I can't really remember. That's a long, long time ago. But, yeah. You know, it was, you know, basically we're saying, well, this is how you measure, you know, like, measure moments, you know, type of thing. But no one could really, I mean, there really isn't. You know, what is the best description of time and how we understand it? You know, you said the lineal time, that's all we can really understand, right?
My favorite definition of time, physicist, I forget his first name, William Phillips, maybe. Well, he quoted this, I guess it was Einstein that first said it, but he would often respond to that question with, time is what clocks measure. And that was it. Because no, but if when people like Einstein don't fully understand what time is, and we have gotten a much better idea since then, and especially with research into quantum mechanics and particle physics and cosmology and the formation of the universe, we have a much better understanding than we used to. But it's still something that eludes us. And I think that's awesome that your teacher asked that question, and especially with no clarity given whatsoever, just throwing it out there and say, all right, you guys figure it. That's a great teaching tool, heuristic devices, we call them, because it forces you to think, well, what is he asking, or she, I don't know.
Yeah.
And what? Why did they ask that? And, well, what if they were asking it for this reason? Then you have to go and look at all of these different things, and you get a much deeper insight into that thing. And with time, it takes that. With something as complex as time, it takes really coming at it in all of these different ways. And I remember our social media site for academics, or at least where we can keep track of publications and who's publishing what, when, is a site called ResearchGate. And I think it was last year sometime, one of my peer reviewers asked a very specific and insightful question related to a specific aspect of time. And because there's so many different academics from all over the world on this site, I just posted her question, copy and pasted it onto ResearchGate. And within a day, there were something like 200 responses by PhDs in physics and philosophy and history and astronomy, just coming out of the woodwork because people are so passionate about it. And it's this one of the last great unknowns is not just what time is, but how do we really understand it, and how could we manipulate it potentially in the same way that you see with all of these celestial bodies and black holes, where there's this tremendous warpage of space and time, and with very rapid movement, high velocity. And it was really insightful. I read every single one of them, and I'd kind of jump in from time to time. But I really just watched as this really complex conversation unfolded in front of me because of this one simple question that one of my peer reviewers asked about. And I think that's a testament to how interesting, but yet how elusive the question of time really is.
Right, right. Now, the one question I have for you, now there have been people reporting abductions. The earliest known one was in the 1920s, and then you really didn't hear of anything. Then you heard 1962 with Betty and Barney Hill, and then then you started, and then Travis Walton, and then you started hearing more and more of them. I guess the question is for you is why now? Why in the modern, more what we're going to call the modern times, modern UFO, you know, we call the modern UFOs 1947 till now type of mm-hmm. thing. But why would you suspect that there wasn't these situations happening prior to, or do you think they may have been happening and just not reported?
I think they've been happening as far back into the past as our future descendants are able to go. I think, and that's probably a really, it might be an evolving point in the past too, where with advances in technology, with the ability to go faster, well, light cones are oriented toward the past and you can create closed time light curves. I think the challenge will be how fast can they go? What time can they get to physically in the past? And I think that will be a really important threshold and one that will continue to be pushed because it's important. If you're studying the past and you are able to collect data from that past, the earlier you can go, the more information you have, the broader the span of your knowledge is. So I think from whatever point they're able to, they have been doing it. And I can't say what point in the past that is. I think I actually saw, and I think it was maybe even under hypnosis, Jim Peniston talking about the information he was given, binary code type of situation. Oh, yeah. But mentioned the same thing. I found this after I published the book, so it was really interesting to see. But them even saying they could only go, I think it was something like 50,000 years into the past just because of limitations and their craft and the speed at which they could obtain. So, I think it's probably two things. An aspect of that is somewhat becoming normalized, and that's really amazing to see right now that it's something that's coming out in the media more, and it's becoming something that's discussed, and those that have said no, UFOs aren't real are now having to really take a step back and think about that and try to assess whether they're just being closed-minded or have biases or just really don't want them to be real. But in any case, I think that at some point we're going to have to come to grips with this, that if this has been happening, if this is happening now and it's becoming normalized, we're going to hear about it more. And as we hear about it more, it's going to help with that normality. And you can kind of hear this drip, drip, drip of disclosure that we're just moving toward this point where it might be something that's widely acknowledged. And I write about that toward the end of the book, where if we do get to the point where there isn't secrecy surrounding the subject, and these are indeed our future descendants coming back through time, and we don't have to worry about disruptions to space-time or the butterfly effect or anything like that, it's possible that in the future, even the proximate future, the next 100 years or 20 years or whatever point they decide we're ready to know this, it could be as common to hang out with people from 1,000 years in the future as it is now to hang out with people from sub-Saharan Africa or Australia or the Far East or Europe or the United States, wherever. We see variation geographically, what we refer to as geographic race or ancestry. But in the future, we could potentially be interacting with people who have temporal ancestry. They have variation resulting from where they came from in time. And I think that would be an amazing thing to see. And I certainly hope it happens in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to just another thing that I was just thinking of just now is that a lot of times we think of, oh, people in even sometimes just a few hundred years in the past maybe not being as bright as us. And I don't agree with that at all. As a matter of fact, I transcribed a 6-page letter of George Washington wrote, and I had to use the dictionary 25 times. And there wasn't, and then those 6 pages, there wasn't one single misspell. And
wow.
They
were writing it by hand, weren't they?
They were like,
there
beautiful,
was nothing
beautiful
else. There was no spell check. Yeah.
Beautiful handwriting.
Amazing.
And but you go back in time and, you know, we just assume that people weren't as bright. And I disagree. I feel like people have been, you know, just as smart. And you know, I mean, you just for a college person to pass a fourth grade test that was 200 years ago may be difficult. You know, I mean, there's... Anyway, what I'm getting at is, do you think there is a trend toward an evolutionary trend to actual brain size actually growing?
Well, that's an interesting question. There's a couple of things going on with that. Yes, our brains have certainly been growing larger over evolutionary time, and it's an accelerating change. Over the last 800,000 years in particular, our brains have been getting much bigger. They've shrunk a little bit over the last 10,000 years, which is actually just a result of our overall body size reducing. Since about 25,000-30,000 years ago, across the board, almost every human group has seen a reduction in body size. But what's important to keep in mind is it's not just size when it comes to the brain. In fact, a lot of my research specifically looks at MRIs and the connections among the brain, the thickness of different gyri within the brain, the relationship to eye size, how the eye relates to different structures within the brain as well. And one thing I've found in researching these things is that it's almost, as far as intelligence goes, better to have a smaller brain. There's denser connections. It's dendritic density that really plays into intelligence more than just the overall size of the brain. With that said, there's no doubt that our increase in brain size over the last 4 to 5 million years in particular, and especially in the last 800,000 years, there's no doubt that it's correlated with intelligence. We can see that clearly in our culture and the evolution of technology. They're very intricately linked. But in looking at differences among modern humans or between the sexes or what have you, size of the brain isn't that important. Most of it comes down to organization of the brain, the density of the dendritic connections, the shape. And that's the main thing to keep in mind. As you talked about earlier, how we define modern humans. Well, we actually do have a definition for that. And the two main traits that define anatomically modern Homo sapiens sapiens are that globularity that I mentioned earlier, the rounded skull shape where our parietal lobes and our temporal lobes have expanded mediolaterally or from inside out. But then also facial retraction to the extent that we have a chin or a mental eminence, as we call it. So the chin is actually one of the criteria we use. And another thing to keep in mind is that we're talking about a continuous change. So we can't necessarily just draw a discrete line in this continuum and say, now we have modern humans. That's the first person there with a bulbous cranium and a chin. It doesn't work that way. It's a continuum. So a lot of people like to speculate that aliens came down and made modern humans, or there's this big jump that happened. That's just not true. There's no evidence for that whatsoever. We see this continuous change, but we as anthropologists have to have some criteria with which to mark that change or mark that new form. And those are the two main characteristics we use. So to answer your question, size of the brain, what happens from now on isn't as important as what shape changes take place and how those shape changes are associated with other characteristics in the face and the body in the context of neoteny, pedomorphosis. Retaining juvenilized traits into adulthood is a big part of the shape change that we see. So, brain size is important, has been important, but it's really more about how our brains are connected, what's going on inside them, and at least in the sense of what we see from the outside, what that overall shape of the brain is.
This is probably kind of a bizarre question, but is there...
Those are my favorite kinds of questions, just so you know.
Okay. Is there a part of the brain that could develop enough, or has there ever been any research into what makes someone be able to have telepathy, to send like a telepathic message? Is there part of the brain that would originate or start to develop or could?
That actually, it's really funny you mentioned that, is the subject of my next research project. I would really like to know that too. And I just actually agreed to co-author a book with another PhD who also has a very deep interest in this, and for very good reason. And we've talked a lot about consciousness and telepathy and lucid dreaming and teleportation. It was mentioned earlier. Alejandro mentioned it in his news report. Remote viewing.
Yes.
You know, people claim to be able to do this, and mm-hmm. there's a lot of evidence that, you know, some people are actually doing these things. We're planning to research that more. To my knowledge, no. It's one of these things that, much like studying UFOs or talking about UFOs and aliens, just instantly gets you nowhere in academia.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people that have research that, don't get me wrong, but at least in the sense of getting grant money to do functional MRI analyses of which part of the brain is firing when someone is remote viewing or connecting with another brain telepathically. I think there's a lot of room to move about the cabin there. There's a lot of research that could help us with actual testable hypotheses. Like I mentioned before, it's important in doing these things to work within the scientific method and to develop testable hypotheses and data collection. And I'd like to continue with that in this research. And that, to me, is the next big question, is to understand consciousness and to understand people's psychic abilities. Certain people have real abilities to tell what's going to happen in some capacity or another. And telepathy, I think, is just a big part of that overarching aspect of consciousness that I think is something that humanity should certainly be looking into more.
Yeah, yeah. It certainly would save a lot of time and, you know, could get rid of the cell phones and all that.
Well, as someone pointed out previously, though, it would make podcasters' jobs somewhat difficult. You know, how do you do your job if everyone's communicating telepathically?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So tune in to hear, tune into the noggin. Yeah,
this brainwave, this frequency.
Yeah, yeah, that's pretty funny. So I do want to let you know that I did put the phone number up. We are accepting calls for those of you over at KGRA Radio. Write this number down. It's 603-967-4030. If anyone would like to give us a jingle and you got a question for Dr. Masters, feel free to give us a call. I think this is a very fascinating topic. It's a little...
Do you mind if I plug the book?
Absolutely. Go right to it. Yes.
Well, the name of the book is Identified Flying Objects, a Multidisciplinary Scientific Approach to the UFO Phenomenon. And it's available on all major platforms. The website's probably the best place to find places to purchase it or to find out more information or talks. I think it came up earlier that I'd be at the International UFO Congress in Phoenix in September. I'll be speaking at the MUFON 50th anniversary event in Irvine, California in late July. So there's a lot going on. There's a lot of moving bits and pieces. And like I've said from the beginning, it's just an evolving process, an evolving project. And doing things like this, having conversations with you right now is a very important part of that.
Yeah. Yep. I would put I've actually got bumped off of YouTube monetization actually when I put a cover of a book up, so I can't do that anymore. But it is easy to find on Amazon, or actually you have, as you mentioned, your website, which actually stands for Identified Objects, right? Is that what that is?
Yeah, yeah. It's just a shortened version of the book, idflyobj.com, IDFLY. OBJ, which in retrospect, I was on Coast to Coast and George Norrie was, you know, doing the whole spiel, and he was like, and his website is just a random string of numbers. All right, we'll be right back. A random string of letters, he said. I was like, yeah, he's right. I probably should have done something else. But IFO was taken. I couldn't use IFO. And that was the next best idea in my mind is I'd fly OBJ. But yeah. No, George Norrie called me out, and he was valid in doing so. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, again, the line's open if anyone would like to call in. And so on, as far as the future traits of the human anatomy, you said a lot of it is shaped around environment, I know, you know, food, supply of food and all that. But do you think that we're, I was talking earlier about intelligence and, you know, some, I've heard people say this, and I don't know if it's just people talking or whatever, but they say people are getting less intelligent. There's no way to track that. That's not really happening, is it, that you're aware of?
Oh, no, there's tons of ways to track that. Absolutely. And we do all the time. Yeah. Anytime you see any quantitative metric about schools or tests, or especially because we've standardized tests for so long, IQ tests are, I don't know what the FCC rules are, so I'll just use a nice term, are bunk, essentially. Yeah. And were developed for very horrible reasons as part of the eugenics movement, and they're very racist. And,
oh, really?
And I don't lend much credence to IQ tests, but there are standardized tests that are very useful, and we can compare these across different countries, across different demographic groups, obviously different ages, different ethnicities and whatnot, and see what our intelligence is like. And yeah, we've been falling by the wayside, certainly. And as you mentioned, I think it's important to think about this, too, is were people smarter in the past? Sure, as you mentioned, they were able to write without spelling errors, with very beautiful handwriting, and they took their time to do it. But what did they really produce, and how quickly did they produce it? Culture builds on top of culture, and technology builds on top of technology, and there are people that drive that forward who are very, very smart people. But it almost sounds like you're asking, are we as a species or the average of humans sort of devolving?
Yeah.
Or getting, am I off in left field there?
No, that's exactly what where I was going. Yes.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that comes down to a couple of things. This is anecdotal to some extent, but there is also data to back this up and studies to back this up, that on average there are more less intelligent people in this country than in the past. And that could partly be because there were fewer people in the past. It also comes down to birth rates among different demographic groups, and especially those in poverty. They tend to have more children. But that's also socio-political, that they have less access to birth control and less education about ways to prevent unwanted births. There's also more rape and abuse and a number of things that play into it. So yeah, and looking at if we are sort of devolving or getting dumber, we have to also factor into it the economic situation and the political situation. If we're cutting access to education, healthcare, preventative measures, then yeah, you could definitely see the beginning of a trend that would continue to push us toward more people that have a lower education and therefore less intelligence, as indicated by these standardized tests.
You know, I myself have seen a trend in just what I do. As far as, you know, your phone has spell check for you now. You know, there's all these little things that...
Calculators.
Yeah. All the things that you used to write out, write out and really, you know, use your brain for. It's so much easier to ask Siri or Alexa or whatever it is. But in that way in particular, I can see that technology is harmful to us and actually...
But let me ask you this. Does that mean we're dumber, or does that mean we're smarter? Because again, on average, you know, regardless of what we can do or can't do within our brains, we're still able to learn this technology, and we're still able to learn how to use these apps and this constantly evolving technology that we have to adapt to. And even though, yeah, we might be getting dumber in certain segments of the population, I feel like we're still... We still are required to do things that 100 years ago just wouldn't really even be something we could conceptualize. So I don't know. It's a tough one. I think it's a multifaceted thing. I'm really glad you brought it up, actually, because it's something that I think we all kind of bounce around in our heads and is something we should have more of a discussion about.
Yeah. You know, getting back to the topic that, you know, my show's about UFOs, basically. Do you think that, or is some of your thoughts that what people are seeing as far as a UFO are actually carrying people, you know, from the future to the past? Or do you think some of them are? Is that kind of your theory, that these are actually time machines?
Yeah, I do. That's the a main argument in the book, is that these devices, these UFOs themselves, are the actual time machine. And I look at, like I mentioned earlier, some of the early solutions to Einstein's field equations, and most of them involved some sort of rotating cylinder or solenoid or a disc, many times a disc, especially in more recent research. And the main thing that happens, the main way in which you can travel into the past, that you reorient light cones toward the past, and a light cone is just all of the possibilities within the speed of light, within the laws of physics, any moment radiating out into the future. If you can imagine beams of light on either side, it creates this probability layer, this cone of probabilities, which is what's known as a light cone. But in order to travel into the past, you have to reorient those toward the past. You have to get them to tip over so that you can actually move physically into a past period. And one of the this has been demonstrated many times. It's something that we understand. We can't create it yet. More recent research actually is starting to investigate these things in a laboratory setting and look into how we create these frame dragging, lens throwing effects to create an actual time machine. But what they all come down to is the rotation, or at least a dominant theme throughout, is the rotation of a highly massive or highly energetic disk. And if you think about black holes, the only thing in the known universe that can actually send matter back in time, at the event horizon, the Schwarzschild radius of a black hole, that is when it disappears from our four dimensions of space-time. Even light can't penetrate that event horizon because of the massive gravitation. And I certainly don't think that these UFOs, or IFOs as I call them in the book, are like black holes. The tidal forces of a black hole and singularity associated with it would rip apart anything that entered it. But a good surrogate for that is the electromagnetic force. And what a lot of people don't realize is the electromagnetic force is 10 to the 40 times stronger than gravity. We think of gravity as this thing that holds us to the Earth, and it holds the Earth to the Sun and the Moon to the Earth, and it is an important force of the four forces in nature. But electromagnetism is so much stronger. So if we could harness that electromagnetic force and still create this frame dragging effect, or this rotational energy that's needed to reorient those light cones toward the past, we could potentially create a time machine without having to create singularities associated with black holes and the physics and particle physics involved with that. So, an idiom, a common mantra in biology is that form follows function. And that applies to anything. And it certainly applies here, I think, where the form of these craft and the properties that they have, the common description of them being disc-like and having and rotating, could facilitate the function of backward time travel. So yeah, I really do believe, and I feel like I make a strong argument for this in the book, that these are the actual time machines themselves.
Wow, amazing, amazing. And the Foo Fighters mostly were orbs, so that doesn't kind of follow that same line, you know. I mean, mostly what people were seeing, or
no. I'd like to address that.
Yeah,
briefly,
go ahead.
Actually,
sure.
Is I don't think all of them are. There are things like what was described recently, the cube and the orb, or the something like that. I've been shown images of things that appear to be drones that certainly aren't time machines. Many of them are more circular, but the actual craft, the large, I hate to use this word because it's so cliche, but mothership type craft, they do seem to have the capacity. What comes out of those to do whatever sort of thing is happening? Obviously, you're not just going to take that down in someone's bedroom and see if you can get in there to abduct them at that time. You're going to send a little a little probe, a little drone type thing. So I think a lot of the UFO phenomenon is people observing those types of things that are being sent out by our time traveling descendants in order to do their research, pick up a couple people, do their biomedical examination, then return to their own time without having to really be there and hovering over large metropolitan areas. So I think a lot of the UFO phenomenon is just what they're sending out as part of their research mission.
Wow. Wow. And care to speculate how many thousands and thousands of years in the future you think that this could be?
I hate speculating about that. However, to be fair, I was just talking about being on Coast to Coast a couple months ago, and George Norrie made me do it. He wouldn't go to commercial really until I did it. So if I do it for George Norrie, I feel like I should have to do it for everyone who asked that question. But the number I gave him, it was I think around 20,000 years.
That's not that long, really.
But again, it's also complicated because we could potentially have the technology to do this in a couple thousand years, but we also wouldn't expect to see people from that time because they likely already have records of what happened, and we wouldn't be that interesting to them. There's no real incentive to do it. So I think the vast majority of accounts, abduction accounts and whatnot, where we see these more evolved humans with still very hominin traits but slightly derived versions of them, based on those is where I get that 20,000 year estimate. Though I think the technology will probably be available before that. It just won't be used for this necessarily. And it's important to keep in mind, too, that once that technology exists, as I mentioned earlier in the context of Novikov's self-consistency principle, none of these things are ahead of or behind the other once that time machine is developed. So there could potentially be an IFO chocked full of our future humans who actually have the technology, who went back and picked up a bunch of Neanderthals, and maybe they dropped some off just to mess with us, and that's where the Bigfoot Sasquatch thing comes from. They pick them up in the past, they come back and get a couple humans from 1,000 years in the future, and then some major celebrity just because it's funny, and then pick us up, and we're looking at this whole spectrum of human evolution because they have the technology to do that. So I think it's important that even, when I throw out this arbitrary number, because obviously I have no idea, I'm just speculating, but based on those physical traits, they seem to be from a period in our future that's somewhat consistent with 20,000 to 50,000 years. But anybody could be in there. They can pick up anybody they want within the limits of what their craft can do, within the limits of when the earliest point their craft can reach. So I think we need to still consider holistically and think about the whole of space-time and not just when they might be coming from in the future.
Yeah. I'm sure you probably caught the headline a few months ago where it said a major breakthrough in time travel, and it ended up just being something with a quantum computer, and it really
was
disappointing, wasn't it?
I know, it was.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a question in the chat room. Constantinius, that's the screen name. Have you ever come in contact with Bashar, B-A-S-H-A-R? Bashar shares the same concept of them being descendants, thus from the future. Are you aware of that name?
I'm not, but I would like to respond to that question by saying that I have been really excited about how many people have also thought of this and have also researched this tremendously. And I certainly plan on looking this person up as well, because what I've also found is that we've all come at it with a similar sort of reason, but with very different things to add. And I've always said that, this is an evolving project and I'm just trying to put some pieces of the puzzle in where they might fit, and then hopefully start more dialogue and more conversation, especially among my academic peers, because this is what science is supposed to be, is asking questions about things that are unknown. So I would hope that more people would start to look at these questions and develop testable hypotheses. But I've already been really excited by how many other people have really thought about this in deep terms. And I've had the chance to talk to many of them with really exciting conversations. Okay. I signed a contract to start working with a TV production company with a couple really amazing people who are excited about the project and who have also thought about this and have really been excited to build this and to present it in a more mainstream audience.
I sure hope they don't go off the fringe side with it to make it more
well. No. That was the very first thing we talked about. The very first thing.
I can see by your manner in general that you would.
Oh
make
my
that
God!
Important.
No, yeah. You guys spoke about Ancient Aliens earlier. I've been contacted by two producers of Ancient Aliens in the last 5 months. And I hope we can find common ground soon because I really would like to be on the show, but I'm not going to sell out my integrity.
Good for you.
I'm not gonna lie. I'm not gonna make things up. And these guys know that we've had some really great discussions, and I'm really excited to work with them. I think it'll be phenomenal.
Great. We do have a caller on the line. Caller, your first name. Where are you calling from?
James, and I'm in Bellevue, Washington.
Oh, yes, James, you've called in before, and you're kind of a science-y type guy. How are you?
Yes, that's right.
Yes,
I'm
welcome.
Good. Great show.
Thank
Terrific.
You. Yes.
I really can't wait to read the book, and I like the whole idea of the IFOs. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are. There's such a huge variety of descriptions of the various ships. There's triangles and mm-hmm. I've heard of rectangles and yeah. and saucers and all of that. And do you think it is possible that there are other cultures or species that may be visiting, or maybe they're von Neumann probes or something along those lines?
Yeah, that's a great question. I actually really appreciate that question because it's something that I didn't really go into in much detail in the book, but I wished I'd had once I published it. You'll be able to see where that should have gone and where I wished I would have put it if you end up getting it. But one thing I would like to mention, I don't necessarily think that they're extraterrestrial. There are different shapes, absolutely. There's the cigar shape is a very common one. What I personally think, and I'm just speculating here, but what I personally think is that the triangle ones are ours now.
Man-made.
There's a lot of talk about that.
Well, modern man-made, because if you think about it, if they don't have to worry about the time travel aspects, if they don't have to maintain that symmetrical shape, and have a material that can withstand not just the centrifugal forces, but all of the kinetic forces and the friction and spinning something that fast and with that much energy.
And the tidal forces.
Yeah, exactly. But the triangles almost seem like a primitive attempt by us to use that anti-gravity electromagnetic propulsion system to still make something that's unidentifiable to us because we're used to vector propulsion and we're used to airplanes with jets or helicopters. But I almost think the triangles are ours. I almost think that those have been developed perhaps even with technology that was acquired during the Roswell crash where we reverse engineered it and figured out 50 years is a long time. We're almost at like 70 years now since that happened. So that's right. So that's actually a very long time to reverse engineer something like that. I personally think the triangles, and again, I'm just speculating, but those shapes where it's just about trying to get stability. Like if you think about sitting on a chair, you have three legs, you're going to wobble in three different directions. You have four, you're better situated for that. So that takes some of the variables out of it, where it's not a rotational thing. It's not like trying to maintain a rotating frisbee in the air, but it's just these three places where you have to control those independently.
Well, I would argue, I'm actually going to have to cut this short, but because we are out of time. And thanks for the call.
Okay. Well, thanks, Martin.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Thanks, James.
And I wish I had longer time to argue the triangular UFO with you.
I'd still like to hear your idea.
Okay, well, hang on. Don't
you give me cliff notes.
Okay, wait. Don't go away. Stay on Skype for a minute. And this is going to be the end of the show. Again, I want to thank everyone for helping out with the show. And Alejandro, at the first part of the show, and a guest, of course, Dr. Michael Masters. You can get his book. Check it out online. Go ahead and throw that website out there one more time, if you would.
IdFlyObj.com. IdFlyObj.
Okay. Since you are on, and I'm asking you to stay on, there's going to be an outro. You're not going to hear it, so you're just going to have to hang in there and not make any noises because we're going to go into it. So thanks so much for everyone. Everyone for listening, and we'll see you next week. I'm not sure who our guest will be, but remember to keep your eyes to the sky.